Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Messini. Tonight, Tom Bacon continues his reading from the writings of Mark Twain about his time as a riverboat pilot on the Mississippi River.
This chapter of Old Times on the Mississippi is called Continued Perplexities. Yeah, there was no use in arguing with a person like this. I promptly put such a strain on my memory that by and by, even the shoal water and the countless crossing marks began to stay with me. But the result was just the same. I never could more than get one knotty thing learned before another presented itself. Now, I had often seen pilots gazing at the water and pretending to read it as if it were a book, but it was a book that told me nothing. A time came at last, however, when Mr. Bixby seemed to think me far enough advanced to bear a lesson on water reading. So he began, "Do you see that long, slanting line on the face of the water? Now, that's a reef. Moreover, it's a bluff reef. There's a solid sandbar under it that is nearly straight up and down as the side of a house. There's plenty of water close up to it, but mighty little on top of it. If you were to hit it, you'd knock the boat's brains out. Do you see where the line fringes out at the upper end and begins to fade away? Yes, sir. Well, that's a low place. That's the head of the reef. You can climb over there and not hurt anything. Cross over now and follow along close under the reef. Easy water there. Not much current." I followed the reef along until I approached the fringed end. Then Mr. Bixby said, "Now get ready. Wait till I give you the word. She won't want to mount a reef. The boat hates shoal water. Stand by. Wait. Wait. Keep her well in hand. Now, cramp her down. Snatch her, snatch her." He seized the other side of the wheel and helped us spin it around until it was hard down, and then we held it so. The boat resisted and refused to answer for a while. Next she came surging to starboard, mounted the reef, and sent a long, angry ridge of water foaming away from her bows. "Now watch her like a cat, or she'll get away from you. When she starts to fight strong and the tiller slips a little in a jerky, greasy sort of way, then let her up a trifle. That's the way she tells you at night the water's too shoal. But keep edging her up little by little toward the point. You're well up on the bar now. There is a bar under every point, because that water comes around it, forms an eddy, and allows the sediment to sink. You see those fine lines on the face of the water that branch out like the ribs of a fan? Well, those are little reefs. You just want to miss the ends of them, but run them pretty close. Now look out. Look out! Don't you crowd that slick, greasy-looking place. There ain't 9 feet there. She won't stand it. She begins to smell it. Look sharp, I tell you! Oh, blazes, there you go. Stop the starboard wheel. Quick! Ship up to back. Set her back!" The engine bells jingled, and the engines answered promptly, shooting white columns of steam far aloft out of the escape pipes. The foamy ridges that radiated from her bows suddenly disappeared. A great dead swell came rolling forward and swept ahead of her. She careened far over to larboard and went tearing away toward the other shore as if she were about scared to death. We were a good mile from where we ought to have been when we finally got the upper hand of her again. During the afternoon watch the next day, Mr. Bixby asked me if I knew how to run the next few miles. I said, "Go inside the first snag above the point, outside the next one, start out from the lower end of Higgins Woodyard, make a square crossing, and..." "That's all right. I'll be back before you close up on the next point." But he wasn't. He was still below when I rounded it and entered upon a piece of the river which I had some misgivings about. I didn't know that he was hiding behind a chimney to see how I'd perform. I went gaily along, getting prouder and prouder, for he had never left the boat in my sole charge for such a length of time before. I even got to setting her and letting the wheel go entirely, while I vaingloriously turned my back and inspected the stern marks and hummed a tune, sort of an easy indifference which I had prodigiously admired in Bixby and other great pilots. Once I inspected rather long, and when I faced to the front again, my heart flew into my mouth so suddenly that if I hadn't clapped my teeth together, I should have lost it. One of those frightful bluff reefs was stretching its deadly length right across our bow. My head was gone in an instant. I didn't know which end I stood on. I gasped and couldn't get my breath. I spun the wheel down with such rapidity that it wove itself together like a spider's web. Well, the boat answered and turned square away from the reef, but the reef followed her. I fled, but still it followed, still it kept right across my bows. I never looked to see where I was going, I only fled. The awful crash was imminent. Why didn't that villain come? If I committed the crime of ringing a bell, I might get thrown overboard, but better that than kill the boat. So in blind desperation, I started such a rattling shivery down below as had never before sounded an engineer in this world, I fancy. Amidst the frenzy of the bells, the engines began to back and fill in a furious way, and my reason forsook its throne. We were just about to crash into the woods on the other side of the river. Just then, Mr. Bixby stepped calmly into view on the hurricane deck, and my soul went out to him in gratitude. My distress vanished. I would have felt safe on the brink of the Niagara with Mr. Bixby on the hurricane deck. He blandly and sweetly took his toothpick out of his mouth, between his fingers, as if it were a cigar. We were just in the act of climbing an overhanging big tree, and the passengers were scudding astern like rats. And he lifted up these commands to me ever so gently. Stop the starboard, stop the larboard, set her back on both. The boat hesitated, halted, pressed her nose among the bows a critical instant, and then reluctantly began to back away. Stop the larboard, come ahead on it, stop the starboard, come ahead on it. Pointed for the bar. I sailed away as serenely as a summer's morning. Mr. Bixby came in and said with mock simplicity, When you have a hail, my boy, you ought to just tap the big bell 3 times before you land so the engineers can get ready. I blushed under the sarcasm and said I hadn't any hail. Ah, then it was for wood, I suppose. The officer of the watch will tell you when he wants to wood up. I went on consuming and said I wasn't after wood. Indeed? Why, what could you even want over here in the bend, then? Did you ever know of boat following a bend upstream at this stage of the river? No, sir, I wasn't trying to follow it. I was getting away from a bluff reef. No, it wasn't a bluff reef. There isn't one within 3 miles of where you were. But I saw it. It was just as bluff as that one yonder. Just about. Run over it. Do you give that as an order? Yep. Run over it. If I don't, I wish I may die. All right, I'm taking the responsibility. I was just as anxious to kill the boat now as I had been to save it before. I impressed my orders upon my memory to be used at the inquest and made a straight break for the reef. As it disappeared under our bows, I held my breath, but we slid over it like oil. Now, don't you see the difference? It wasn't anything but a wind reef. The wind does that. Well, so I see, but it is exactly like a bluff reef. How am I ever going to tell them apart? I can't tell you that. It's an instinct. By and by, you'll just naturally know one from the other, but you'll never be able to explain why or how you know them apart. That turned out to be true. The face of the water in time became a wonderful book, a book that was a dead language to the uneducated passenger, but which told its mind to me without reserve, delivering its most cherished secrets as secretly, as clearly, as if it uttered them with a voice. And it was not a book to be read once and thrown aside either, for it had a new story to tell every day. Throughout the long 1,200 miles, there was never a page that was void of interest, never one that you could leave unread without loss, never one that you'd want to skip, thinking you could find higher enjoyment in some other thing. There never was so wonderful a book written by man. Never one whose interest was so absorbing, so unflagging, so sparklingly renewed with every reperusal. The passenger, who could not read it, was charmed with a particular sort of faint dimple on its surface, on rare occasions when he did not overlook it altogether. But to the pilot, that was an italicized passage. Indeed, it was more than that. It was a legend of the largest capitals with a string of shouting exclamation marks at the end of it. For it meant that a wreck or a rock was buried there that could tear the life out of the strongest vessel that ever floated. It is the faintest and simplest expression the water ever makes, and the most hideous to a pilot's eye. In truth, the passenger, who could not read this book, saw nothing but all manner of pretty pictures in it, painted by the sun and shaded by the clouds, whereas to the trained eye, those were not pictures at all, but the grimmest and most dead earnest of reading matter. Now, when I had mastered the language of this water, and had come to know every trifling feature that bordered the great river as familiarly as I knew the letters of the alphabet, I had made a valuable acquisition. But I had lost something, too. I had lost something that could never be restored to me while I lived. All the grace, the beauty, the poetry had gone out of that majestic river. I still keep in mind a wonderful sunset which I witnessed when steamboating was new to me. A broad expanse of the river was turned to blood. In the middle distance, the red hue brightened into gold, through which a solitary log came floating, black and conspicuous. In one place, a long, slanting mark lay sparkling upon the water. In another, the surface was broken by boiling, tumbling rings that were as many-tinted as an opal. Where the ruddy flush was faintest was a smooth spot that was covered with graceful circles and radiating lines, ever so delicately traced. The shore on our left was densely wooded, and the somber shadow that fell from this forest was broken in one place by a long, ruffled trail that shone like silver. And high above the forest wall, a clean-stemmed dead tree waved a single leafy bough that glowed like a flame in the unobstructed splendor that was flowing from the sun. There were graceful curves, reflected images, woody heights, soft distances, and over the whole scene, far and near, the dissolving lights drifted steadily, enriching it with every passing moments, with new marvels of coloring. I stood like one bewitched. I drank it in a speechless rapture. The world was new to me, and I had never seen anything like this at home. But as I've said, a day came when I began to cease from noting the glories and the charms which the moon and the sun and the twilight wrought upon the river's face. Another day came when I ceased altogether to note them. Then, if that sunset scene had been repeated, I should have looked upon it without rapture and should have commented upon it inwardly after this fashion. This sun means we're going to have wind tomorrow. That floating log means the river is rising, small thanks to it. That slanting mark on the water refers to a bluff reef which is going to kill somebody's steamboat one of these nights if it keeps on stretching out like that. Those tumbling boils show a dissolving bar and a changing channel there. The lines and circles in the slick water over yonder are a warning that a troublesome place is shoaling up dangerously. That silver streak in the shadow of the forest is the break from a new snag, and he has located himself the very best place he could have found to fish for steamboats. That tall, dead tree with a single living branch is not going to last long. And then how is a body ever going to get through this blind place at night without a friendly old landmark? No, the romance and beauty were all gone from the river. All the value any feature of it had for me now was the amount of usefulness it could furnish toward compassing the safe piloting of a steamboat. Since those days, I have pitied doctors from my heart. What does the lovely flush in a beauty's cheek mean to a doctor but a break that ripples above some deadly disease? Are not all her visible charms sown thick with what to him are the signs and symbols of hidden decay? Does he ever see her beauty at all? Or doesn't he simply view her professionally and comment upon her unwholesome condition all to himself? And doesn't he sometimes wonder whether he has gained most or lost most by learning his trade? Chapter 7 in Old Times on the Mississippi is called Completing My Education. Whosoever has done me the courtesy to read my chapters which have preceded this may possibly wonder why I deal so minutely with piloting as a science. It was the prime purpose of these chapters, and I'm not quite done yet. I wish to show in the most patient and painstaking way what a wonderful science it is. Ship channels are buoyed and lighted, and therefore it's comparatively easy to learn to run them. Clear water rivers with gravel bottoms change their channels very gradually, and therefore one needs to learn them but once. But piloting becomes another matter when you apply it to vast streams like the Mississippi and the Missouri, whose alluvial banks cave and change constantly, whose snags are always hunting up new quarters, whose sandbars are never at rest, whose channels are forever dodging and shirking, and whose obstructions must be confronted in all nights and in all weathers without the aid of a single lighthouse or a single buoy. For there is neither light nor buoy to be found anywhere in all this 3,000 or 4,000 miles of villainous river. I feel justified in enlarging upon this great science, for the reason that I feel sure no one has ever yet written a paragraph about it who had piloted a steamboat himself. and so had a practical knowledge of the subject. If the theme were hackneyed, I should be obliged to deal gently with the reader, but since it is wholly new, I have felt at liberty to take up a considerable degree of room with it. When I had learned the name and position of every visible feature of the river, when I had so mastered its shape that I could shut my eyes and trace it from St. Louis to New Orleans, when I had learned to read the face of the water as one would cull the news from the morning paper, and finally, when I had trained my dull memory to treasure up an endless array of soundings and crossing marks and to keep fast hold of them, I judged that my education was complete. And so I got to tilting my cap to the side of my head and wearing a toothpick in my mouth at the wheel. Mr. Bixby had his eye on these airs. One day he said, "What's the height of that bank yonder at Burgess's?" "How can I tell? It's 3/4 of a mile away." "Very poor eye, very poor. Take the glass." I took the glass and presently said, "I can't tell. I suppose that bank is about 1.5 feet high." "Foot and a half? That's a 6-foot bank." "How high was the bank along here the last trip?" "I don't know. I never noticed." "You didn't? Well, you must always do it hereafter." "Why?" "Because you'll have to know a good many things that it tells you. For one thing, it tells you the stage of the river. It tells you whether there's more water or less in the river along here than there was last trip." "The leads tell me that." I rather thought I had the advantage of him there. "Yes, but suppose the leads lie?" "The bank would tell you so, and then you'd stir up those leadsmen a bit. There was a 10-foot bank here last trip, and there's only a 6-foot bank now. What does that signify?" "That the river is 4 feet higher than it was last trip." "Very good. Is the river rising or falling?" "Rising." "No, it ain't." "I guess I'm right, sir. Yonder's some driftwood floating down the stream." "A rise starts the driftwood, but then it keeps on floating a while after the river is done rising. Now, the bank will tell you about this. Wait till you come to a place where it shelves a little. Now, here, you see this narrow belt of fine sediment? That was deposited while the water was higher. You see the driftwood begins to strand, too. The bank helps in other ways. You see that stump yonder on the false point?" "Aye, aye, sir." "Well, the water's just up to the roots of it. You must make a note of that." "Why?" "Because that means there's 7 feet in the chute of 103. "But 103's a long way up the river yet." "That's where the benefit of the bank comes in. There is water enough in 103 now, but there may not be by the time we get there. But the bank will keep us posted all along. You don't run these close chutes on a falling river upstream, and there are precious few of them that you're allowed to run at all downstream. There's a law of the United States against it. The river may be rising by the time we get to 103, and in that case we'll run it. We're drawing, how much? 6 feet aft, 6.5 forward." "Well, you do seem to know something. But what I particularly want to know is if I've got to keep up an everlasting measuring of these banks of this river 1,200 miles, month in and month out?" "Of course." My emotions were too deep for words for a while. Presently I said, "And how about these chutes? Are there many of them?" "I should say so. I fancy we shan't run any of the river this trip as you've seen it run before, so to speak. If the river begins to rise again, we'll go up behind bars that you've always seen standing out of the river, high and dry like the roof of a house. We'll cut across low places that you've never noticed at all, right through the middle of bars that cover 300 acres of river. We'll creep through cracks where you always thought was solid land. We'll dart through the woods and leave 25 miles of river off to one side. We'll see the hindsight of every island between New Orleans and Cairo." "Then I've got to go to work and learn just as much more river as I already know. Just about twice as much more, near as you can come to it." "Well, one lives to find out. I think I was a fool when I went into this business." "Yeah, that's true. And you are yet. But you'll not be when you've learned it." "I can never learn it." "I will see that you do." By and by I ventured again, "Have I got to learn all this thing just as I know the rest of the river, shapes and all, so that I can run it at night?" "Yep. And you've got to have good fare marks from one end of the river to the other that'll help the bank tell you when there's water enough in each of these countless places, like that stump, you know. When the river first begins to rise, you can run a half a dozen of the deepest of them. When it rises a foot more, you can run another dozen. The next foot will add a couple of dozen, and so on. And so, you see, you have to know your banks and marks with a dead moral certainty and never get them mixed. For when you start through one of those cracks, there's no backing out again as there is in the big river. You've got to go through or stay there 6 months if you get caught on a falling river. There are about 50 of these cracks you can't run at all, except when the river's brimful and over the banks. This new lesson is a cheerful prospect. Cheerful enough. And mind what I've just told you. When you start into one of those places, you've got to go through. They're too narrow to turn around in, too crooked to back out of, and the shoal water is always up at the head, never elsewhere. And the head of them is always likely to be filling up little by little, so that the marks you reckon their depth by this season may not answer for next. Learn a new set then every year? Exactly. Cramp her up to the bar. What are you standing up through the middle of the river for? The next few months showed me strange things. On the same day we held that conversation above narrated, we met a great rise coming down the river. The whole vast face of the stream was black with drifting dead logs, broken boughs, and great trees that had caved in and been washed away. It required the nicest steering to pick one's way through this rushing raft, even in daytime, when crossing from point to point, and at night the difficulty was mightily increased. Every now and then a huge log lying deep in the water would suddenly appear right under our bows, coming head on. No use trying to avoid it then. We could only stop the engine, and one wheel would walk over that log from one end to the other, keeping up a thundering racket and careening the boat in a way that was very uncomfortable to passengers. Now and then we'd hit one of those logs, a rattling bang, dead in the water with a full head of steam, and it would stun the boat as though she had hit a continent. Sometimes this log would dodge and stay right across our nose and back the Mississippi up before it. We'd have to do a little crawfishing then to get away from the obstruction. We often hit white logs in the dark, for we couldn't see them till we were right on them. But a black log is a pretty distinct object at night. A white snag is an ugly customer when the daylight's gone. Of course, on the great rise, down came a swarm of prodigious timber rafts from the headwaters of the Mississippi, coal barges from Pittsburgh, little trading scows from everywhere, and broadhorns from Posey County, Indiana, freighted with fruit and furniture. That's the usual term for describing it, although in plain English the freight thus aggrandized was hoop poles and pumpkins. Pilots bore a mortal hatred to these craft, and it was returned with usury. The law required all such helpless traders to keep a light burning, but it was a law that was often broken. All of a sudden, on a murky night, a light would hop up right under our bows almost, and an agonized voice, with a backwoods whang to it, would wail out, "Where in the you going to? Can't you see nothing, you dashed, egg-sucking, sheep-stealing, one-eyed son of a stuffed monkey?" And then for an instant, as we whistled by, the red glare from our furnaces would reveal the scow and the form of the gesticulating orator as if under a lightning flash. And in that instant, our firemen and deckhands would send and receive a tempest of missiles and profanity. One of our wheels would walk off with the crashing fragments of a steering oar, and down the dead blackness would shut again. And that flatboatman would be sure to go into New Orleans and sue our boat, swearing stoutly that he had a light burning all the time, when in truth his gang had the lantern down below to sing and lie and drink and gamble by, and no watch on deck. Once at night, in one of those forest-bordered crevices behind an island, which steamboatmen intensely described with the phrase, "as dark as the inside of a cow," we should have eaten up a Posey County family, fruit, furniture, and all, but that they happened to be fiddling down below, and we just caught the sound of the music in time to sheer off, doing no serious damage, unfortunately, but coming so near to it that we had good hopes for a moment. These people brought up their lantern then, of course, as we backed and filled to get away. The precious family stood in the light of it, both sexes and various ages, and cursed us till everything turned blue. Once a coal boatman sent a bullet through our pilot house when we borrowed a steering oar of him in a very narrow place. I've been reading from Mark Twain's Old Times on the Mississippi, his account of becoming a river pilot and the profession's arcane language from which he took his pen name. The Bookshelf is a production of KPBX in Spokane. Vern Windham, executive producer. I'm Tom Bacon.